Hello and welcome to History Gap. I'm Molly Goodfellow.
And I'm Georgia McAndrew. This is the podcast that bridges the history gender gap and tells you about all the cool, funky women from across history and culture that you should know about.
This week on the podcast, we are talking about Rosalind Franklin. Georgia, do you know what DNA stands for?
I don't know what DNA stands for.
I'm going to try and say it.
Yes, please.
I'm going to try and say it in one word. It stands for deoxyribonucleic acid. I feel very smart right now.
I actually got asked to leave my biology class because I hated it so much and I never went, which is quite rebellious.
Savage.
For me, actually. I was actually quite a studious child, and then the way it works in Scotland is like you can get into university before you finish school. So like, because we do hires in 1 year, basically.
As in, like, start university or just get your place, like, confirmed?
Get your place,
like,
confirmed.
Locked down. Okay.
Yeah, so I was already into university and I was like, I don't need biology.
I hate this shit.
So I would just never go. And then we had these things called prelims, which is, like, what you have before you sit the actual exam. And I got, like, 13% in the exam. And my teacher was like, I think it's best you don't come back. And I was like, same, man. I don't want to be
fine
here.
Fine by me.
So, no, I don't know what DNA is. Well, I know what DNA is. I just don't know. So you know what I mean?
Don't know what it stands for. It's deoxyribonucleic. Oh, fuck's sake. Let's fuck it up at the end. Deoxyribonucleic acid.
Oh, stunning. Well done.
That was so beautifully said.
It really was.
Anyway, we are here to discuss Rosalind Franklin, a scientist known for contributing to the discovery of the molecular structure of DNA. Let's go. Rosalind Franklin was born on the 25th of July 1920 in Notting Hill, London. Her father, Ellis Arthur Franklin, was a politically liberal merchant banker, and her mother was called Muriel Frances Whaley. I like that. I'm like, this is her father's job and his wife's name. It's bad for this podcast. Rosalind grew up as one of five and was the eldest daughter and second eldest child in the family. She had three brothers, David, Colin, and Roland, and a sister called Jennifer. She grew up in an influential British Jewish family. Her great-uncle, Herbert Samuel, was the first practicing Jewish man to serve in the British cabinet. During the Second World War, the Franklin family helped settle Jewish refugees who came to England from Europe escaping the Nazis, and even took two Jewish children into their home who travelled over on the Kinder transport. Rosalind was a very smart child. She attended a private day school in London with her brother Roland, and she was very good at maths, but also enjoyed sports like cricket and hockey.
I wonder what it was like being good at maths.
I had to have a maths tutor just to get me through GCSEs.
It's me too. I had a maths tutor called Mike, and he smelled like old tea, and he was really old and cute.
Oh.
But he wasn't very helpful. I was still terrible at maths.
There was a point where they were like, we're going to have to put you on like a foundation. And I was like, no, I want to be a doctor. I can't. And like, that should have been the first time that I'm obviously not going to be a doctor if I can't even do maths.
I feel like you'd be quite fun as a doctor, though. I could see
it. I'd be fun, but like...
You'd be like, sakes, you're dying.
Like, I'd be fun, but at what cost? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, no one's getting healed, but they're having a great time.
Like, the bedside manner, impeccable, but, like...
The bants
are there. Do I want you doing surgery? Maybe not.
But the actual healing leads a lot to be desired. When she turned 11, she moved schools to another private girls' school, St. Paul's in Hammersmith, which specialised in physics and chemistry. She excelled in languages also, learning German, Latin, and becoming fluent in French.
Oh, God, she's an all-rounder.
I know. God, already I'm intimidated. Fun fact, her music teacher was renowned composer Gustav Holst, and apparently Rosalind was so bad at her music classes that Holst contacted her mother to find out if she might have problems with her hearing or tonsillitis. Savage.
That
but
is
also,
savage.
I quite like to hear that she wasn't perfect.
One of my best friends is one of the smartest people I've ever met, and she was so shit at the cello.
And you were like, yeah!
And sometimes, even though I love her very much, I was like, yes.
It's like,
one thing you're bad at.
You know when the super clever kids in school would maybe one day get like a B on their essays and they cry and you'd be like, a B is a good day for me.
Yeah. Nerds.
She passed her school exams with flying colours, of course, and was given a scholarship which her father suggested she give up to a deserving refugee student. She got a place at Newnham College, Cambridge in 1938 to study chemistry as part of Cambridge's fancy science offerings. In 1941, she graduated with a second class degree. In her last year at university, she met a woman called Adrienne Weil, who had been a student of Marie Curie, the famed physicist and chemist, and the two became friends. Rosalind and Adrienne, not Rosalind and Marie Curie, just to be clear.
Thank you.
After university, Rosalind took up a research fellowship at Cambridge, where she studied in a laboratory under Nobel Prize-winning British chemist Ronald Norrish. Rosalind didn't get on well there. Norrish was famously quite an obstinate man to work with and also suffered with a drinking problem, which Rosalind didn't get on with. In fact, she wrote that it made her despise him completely. She ended up resigning from the fellowship and in 1942 went to work as a research assistant at the British Coal Utilisation Research Association, where she studied the porosity of coal, how porous coal is, as part of the war effort. This work would become the basis of a thesis which would see Rosalind receive a PhD from Cambridge University in 1945. During the war, she also worked as an air raid warden. She was accomplished.
She was accomplished. I feel she's speaking all these languages.
She's got degrees from everywhere.
She's dealing with alcoholic professors.
She's already like these men in my lab.
Holding me back. I mean, I won't lie. I feel like if there's one place you probably don't want someone with drinking problems, it's probably a chemistry lab. A lot of chemicals in there.
Yeah, aligned.
A lot of glass. Bunsen burners.
You just pick up the wrong glass and you've swallowed some sort of dangerous chemical. I wish I could name a chemical. I wish I could name a chemical or an acid.
Anyone, write us in, like, please.
Hyaluronic acid?
Oh, I put that on my face.
Yeah.
Yeah. That could be bad. I wonder if he was brewing his... I mean, this is not by him. I don't know why we're talking about it. I was just wondering if he brewed his own alcohol because he was a chemist. Who knows?
Maybe. Have you ever drunk home-brewed alcohol?
Yes, I've had home-brewed, like, brandy before.
Yeah.
It's good, but it's lethal stuff.
I once went to a house party in Norwich with a bunch of students, and they had been home-brewing gin in their front room, and I drank so much I blacked out and lost my phone, and just spent the next day crying because I was so
depressed.
I was like, this is so dramatic.
There's something about, like, homegrown alcohol. It's just next level.
I do think, don't drink home-brewed alcohol, because I do feel like the risk of dying is higher than if you just buy a Tesco Value vodka.
So true. Anyway. I feel like really her family seemed very, like, humble and, they're taking in the refugees, which obviously they're a Jewish family, so, you know, their lives are being impacted directly what's happening in Germany. But then he makes her give away her own scholarship to, like, a more deserving refugee. Which is really nice.
Mm. And I like to imagine that she kind of was very...
gracious.
She probably wanted to do it if you were raised in that kind of giving family. And I get the impression, like, again, she seems quite a well-connected... Like, I don't think an issue of paying for school was a problem for her. So I don't think giving up the scholarship was, like, a real hardship. It's just, like, a nice gesture.
I do wonder what it would be like to... Do you think people who are that smart know they're that smart?
Yeah, 100%.
Okay.
100%.
I just feel like, wonder what it would be like being that smart in the world.
Could never relate.
No idea. We couldn't even name one chemical. Mine is one that's in our skincare routine.
I can name some of the periodic table. Okay. Don't ask me now.
Okay.
Let me revise and then I'll come back to you.
Great. Looking forward to it.
In 1945, the Second World War finally ended, as we should all hopefully know by this stage of this podcast. Rosalind reached out to her French friend Adrienne to see if she knew of any jobs going. The next year, she introduced Rosalind to Marcel Mathieu, a director at the Centre National de la Recherche Scientifique, a network of institutes and laboratories run by the French government. The year after that, she was offered a job with Jacques Mering in a laboratory where the pair were studying X-ray diffraction. This is a technique where you can reveal structural information about chemical compositions or structures. I definitely know what that means.
I'm fully across what that means and looks like.
In 1951, Rosalind left France and went back to the UK to undertake research at King's College London in their biophysical laboratory. It was here that she applied what she had learned in France to DNA, which we now know stands for...
deoxyribonucleic acid.
Close enough. Her work meant that it would become possible to see clearer X-ray patterns of DNA molecules. She worked on this with PhD student Ray Gosling. When I originally typed this out, definitely typed out Ryan Gosling.
I was just about to say, when I was looking at this, I was like,
Ryan?
That's Ryan Gosling. Is it a descendant? How funny would that be if Ryan Gosling was a descendant of Ray Gosling?
It would be very Ryan Gosling of him.
He's just a chemist Barbie.
Yeah, he's just Ken.
Mm-hmm.
Anywhere else, he'd be a 10. Marie Wilkins was also involved, but the director of the project, John Randall, had never set clear boundaries between them, which led to friction between Rosalind and the other two men.
Whenever we do an episode of History Gap, and it's kind of anything to do with science, and or a woman working in what's typically suspected to be a male field, I just think, could you imagine the mansplaining in that lab?
Yeah, whenever it's like, whenever there are men in close proximity to a woman's project, I'm like, oh, this woman went through so much.
It happened to me recently the other day, where a man just fully took credit for my idea. And I thought, wow, it's 2024, are we still doing that, Chief?
Seething. I get this thing online where I will make a joke, like on the internet, and then a guy will just reply to my joke with like the same joke but written slightly differently, and I'm like, yeah, that's what I meant. Like I knew to say that. That's why it's funny.
But I think with things like that, or like as I was saying about taking credit for your own idea, it's because it's too awkward to be like, oh, but that was my idea, or but I said that joke first.
You
know what I mean?
Yeah, then you just
then you
sound
beggy.
Yeah, you just sound a bit
like,
petty.
Yeah, but then it's like, oh, but it actually was me.
Yeah,
they know it as well.
It's only going to get worse for Rosalind. Mm-hmm. Their research found that there were two DNA forms, A and B. Rosalind looked into the A form and Ray Gosling looked into the B form. Under Rosalind's direction, Ray was able to get a photograph of the B form strand, which technically was a difficult thing to do without Rosalind's direction.
I feel like I know where this is going.
Rosalind continued with this research and was also applying to move to work at Birkbeck College to move away from the hostile workplace. Without her knowledge, Wilkins took the photograph and showed it to James Watson, a scientist at Cambridge who was also studying DNA. Before Franklin managed to publish her research, Watson incorporated the information into his and Francis Crick's successful double helix model that we know today. Their work was published in 1953. Shady.
The shame.
Shady.
Shame on them.
I just like, you'd be raging, wouldn't you?
You would be so raging.
Fully raging.
I mean, she's worked like a long time of her life, like around this kind of thing. And then they've just fully taken credit for it.
It feels like in science, like everything you do before leads to what your the current thing you're working on is. And like the fact that her most recent discovery, like she helped this guy Ray to take this picture of this massive scientific discovery.
Yeah.
And they were just like, oh, pinch that. And like the fact that it wasn't even like she didn't even choose to show it to this man, like another man in her team took it and showed it to another man.
I would plot
nemesis revenge.
And then again, it's kind of what we were saying earlier, like the whole taking credit thing. She can't be like, hey guys, I actually did it first, because they would just be like, no, you didn't.
I did some research into this, actually. So there was a study. There's a study that's published in the Nature Journal, which is like a journal about science and medicine. Mm. And it shows that women get credited less often than men when it comes to science. It found that the gap was in part due to the fact that women would make up large quantities of unacknowledged researchers on projects. So like when you have a study, there'll be like four or five named doctors. And then obviously it's not just four or five people that put together a study. There'll be like other people. Whereas men are like more likely to be in the list of actual named people. One element of this study found that women were 13.24% less likely to be named in articles and 58.40% less likely to be named on patents. So that's when people are inventing stuff, they'll put a patent on it. There are also examples in history of women not getting credited for feats in science and inventions, such as Hollywood actress Hedy Lamarr, who was kind of from that golden age of Hollywood. Mm-hmm. She, with George and Thiel, developed the concept of frequency hopping on radio. So like the idea that if you're kind of transmitting information by radio, you can jump across frequencies and listen into what other people are saying. They did this research and came up with this thing that would have prevented the bugging of military radios. They took it to the US Navy and they ignored their patent, but later used their discovery to develop new technologies. And it's like, maybe if you just listened to women in the first place, you'd save yourself so much time.
So much time, so much effort. I mean, like, I know it's like a huge problem, like in STEM anyway, about the representation of women and their work, which is really frustrating.
I feel like recognition isn't asking for that much. Like, we just would like you to say like, oh yeah, they did this, thumbs up, great, cheers.
I also think like for the men who take credit in it, and the people who, the men, their names again,
see, I'm glad that we don't know them.
Ronald.
No.
No?
James Watson and Francis Crick.
James Watson and Francis Crick. How they must, like, not be, like, deeply ashamed. Like, to be like, no, they're a fraud because they didn't fully come up with it.
Yeah. It just makes me, like, I don't know, I'd feel sick. Too embarrassed.
Yeah.
Because I'd just be like, everyone's gonna know that I just didn't come up with this thing by myself.
Also, it's, like, a pretty complicated thing as well. You'd have to make sure, like, you really knew your stuff.
It doesn't take much to just be like, oh, yeah, and we couldn't have done it without XYZ's help.
Bastards.
It is interesting, though, and we will get, like, we'll get more into this later, but Rosalind herself, like, the kind of the story of the betrayal, Rosalind, I think, herself has said that she didn't see herself as a woman scientist. She saw herself as a scientist first. Didn't see the kind of betrayal...
From a gendered perspective.
Yeah, so she didn't feel like, oh, they did this because I'm a woman. They kind of did it because they're shady and snaky, but not because I'm a woman, just because they could. We'll see. Before Watson and Crick published the paper that used Rosalind's research, she got the job at Birkbeck College and moved to work in their lab there. When there, she worked closely with fellow biophysicist and chemist Aaron Klug. When here, she used her previous experience to look into the structure of RNA in a tobacco mosaic virus. She argued against the common theory that virus particles were different lengths, and she would later be proved correct. Obviously.
It's interesting that, like, she's had, like, multiple discoveries. I kind of feel like you only ever really... Maybe all scientists do, and you only hear about the big ones. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it feels like she's just got, like, all these theories. And she's like, I'll take that off.
She, like, keeps being proved right. She's like, I think this. And then she's just like, yeah, no, I was right, actually. No. You should have just listened to me. She soon turned her expertise to explore the structure of other viruses, and soon she won 3 years of funding for Birkbeck College from America. It was the biggest funding amount for the college of its time. She began research into the polio virus, but unfortunately in 1956 she was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. She received surgery and did return to work, but not for long before she became too ill to work and was cared for by her family until she passed away aged 37 in 1958.
No, so young.
So young, and like such a promising career ahead of her.
It's kind of that thing where it's like, if she'd gone on to live her full life, like how many things we might know.
Yeah, like how, like what could she have discovered?
Yeah.
Especially in terms of, like, I feel like research into DNA and that sort of thing. We still do so much of it now, and there's still so much that we need to learn. Like, I wonder how much further ahead we'd be now if she had lived longer.
Yeah, and like circling back to how we were talking about how women are less likely to be credited or taken seriously in science, I just feel like how much better the world would be if we actually did put women at the forefront of science and things like that, and like things like medicine.
We'd get stuff
done.
We'd
be so much further ahead. Like, imagine holding us back.
Imagine how, like, the state of, like, gynecological research if the women were in charge of researching it.
It'd be incredible.
Not to subtweet the entire science community. Rosalind was an incredibly smart woman who stuck up for herself in her field and would likely have gone on to achieve great things. Her lab partner at Birkbeck, Aaron Klug, would later go on to win the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for a project they began together. Rosalind Franklin gained a contemporary title as a Dark Lady of DNA, and it was meant as an insult by one of her co-workers. But today, many people, like her biographer Brenda Maddox, see it as proof of her strong influence on science. The European Space Agency were inspired to name an ExoMars rover for her in 2019. The rover is programmed to search for genetic molecules or compounds to prove there is life on Mars. In 2012, Rosalind's sister Jennifer Glynn wrote in The Lancet, a science and medical journal, about her sister and her legacy. In it, she writes of how Francis Crick and James Watson won the Nobel Prize for their work on DNA, and they didn't even mention Rosalind in their speech, despite her work helping them achieve their goals. Her sister called this a deliberate omission. They received their prize in 1962, 4 years after her death.
That actually makes you want to cry.
It makes me so sad. Like, not even to name, like, not even to give her, like, a nod of the head and be like, we couldn't have done it without the work. She also writes of how James Watson wrote about Rosalind in his book explaining the story of their discovery, The Double Helix, published in 1982, where he wrote lines such as, "Rosie had to go or be put in her place," which Jennifer wrote, "This unsympathetic image gave great distress to her family and even became a warning to girls who might think of a career in science." And I do think, like, if you are a woman who is working in kind of any industry and you are particularly, like, confident or headstrong or are trying to excel in any way, I think you'll recognise that kind of idea of needing to be put in your place. Mm-hmm. And I think like her sister's right. Like, why, like, girls would look at that and be like, well, why would I want to go into science if anything I achieve is just going to be overtaken by men?
That's the thing. It's like, I could work as hard as men in the room, if not harder, yeah. and I still won't be taken seriously, and they might take my ideas. Yeah. Like, that's why it's like so damaging when women are treated that way in the workplace. It sets an example for not just men, but women too.
Especially in science, where surely, like, especially with DNA, surely everyone's on the same team.
Exactly. That's like, why I think
any win
as well.
Is everyone's win. Like, why do we, like, not to be like, why do we have the Nobel Prize? Because obviously I think that's important. But, like, why is it a case of, like, stealing credit from
yeah,
other people?
Yeah, it's like there's like a theme of like narcissism in it slightly. Or it's like, we're not doing it for scientist discovery, we're doing it for the Nobel Prize.
Exactly. And I think they should all be anonymous. Everyone should be anonymous. Yes. No one should get credit for anything.
Mm. But maybe they wouldn't do anything.
That's true. I also love getting credit for stuff. Interestingly, she also writes about how she feels Rosalind has been put on an unrealistic pedestal and how she thinks she'd feel uncomfortable with the feminist lens she is often seen by. She writes, her story has been adopted by feminists as a symbol of a woman struggling and unacknowledged in a man's world. This would, I think, have embarrassed her almost as much as Watson's account would have upset her. She would have thought of herself simply as a scientist whose achievements should have been judged on their own terms, not as a woman scientist striking a blow for the rights of women. Although she was never an active feminist, perhaps the memorials that would have pleased her best are those that use her name to promote opportunities for young women academics. Which I think is an interesting way to look at it, and I can definitely see why, if you were already feeling like you were kind of downtrodden, you wouldn't want to more bring yourself under that potential, I don't know if scrutiny is the right word, but under that kind of, I think there's like, what am I trying to say? I think there's kind of an extra pressure of, you don't want to be seen as the woman who says that you're only being treated in a certain way because you're a woman.
Yes.
Not to say that she doesn't know what she thinks or believes. Like, I totally respect her not wanting to kind of labour herself in that way. But I do think there is also like a double-edged sword of, firstly, you're treated that way because you're a woman. And secondly, you would then be treated another way if you said, I think this is happening because I'm a woman. There's yes. kind of no way to win.
Yeah, there's no way to win. And also, I think when we think about it in like the historical context of the time, like, I do think modern feminism now, I think a lot of feminists, not all of them, as we know, there's lots of debate, but are very realistic, the fact that because we are women, we are treated the same way. Whereas I think in like the early stages of like first waves of feminism, it was very like, what men can do, I can do. Like, I don't see gender, I don't see the fact that I'm a woman, sort of thing. And we've had it in other episodes before, we've had this kind of same thing. And I could see within like the historical context why to them it's like negative.
Yeah, if you know definitely. What I mean. Like, the idea of if your like kind of vision of feminism's goal is for everyone to be equal, that you wouldn't even kind of want to look at the differences, where like, I think, as you say, now we kind of, we want to acknowledge the differences but like celebrate them and have that level of equality.
Yes, and understand that like our gender, no matter how you identify, really impacts the way that we move through the world and the way that we treat it and we experience it, and therefore it's an important thing to recognize.
Yeah.
So I can understand why she kind of, I think it's like a defensive thing almost, perhaps.
Yeah.
That she wants to be seen as a scientist, not the woman, but actually her being this woman scientist at that time is actually a really cool part of
and
the story.
And also like really interesting that she says that even though she's actively kind of gone through several different experiences in her working life where she has been treated a bit shit and has had to kind of like, for example, when she worked in the laboratory with the guy that was a bit of a drunk, she had to like remove herself from that situation and then move through all these different spaces where she had to assert herself, to still be like, well, no, like, I don't want to be kind of treated with these like women gloves. I just want to be treated as a scientist.
Yeah. And so I don't think it's a rejection of feminism as such. I think it's a different,
it's like a reframing for her. And I think it's really not nice that her sister had to write this letter, but I think it's really, because obviously like Rosalind's life was cut short, and I think it's really cool that she had a sister who
fought for her.
Yeah, and also kind of like, because I think from what I've read and kind of I remember seeing this story in the news a few times, like, it was a very controversial part of history, because it is a really cool discovery
of course
what these men discovered was really great. It is just sort of tainted by this controversy as whether they did or didn't do the right thing in terms of how they credited her. And I think it's great that she had an advocate who kind of put her side across where it likely would have been forgotten.
Yes, definitely. And no surprise, it's obviously another woman doing that. Yes. But we'll take it where we can get it. So I think Rosalind Franklin, what a great scientist.
What a great legacy. A good message. I think standing up for yourself where you can and having women who will stand up for you when you can't, I think is very important. And also, I'm just very pro women that can do science because I cannot.
Yes, it's very impressive. And keep doing.
We need women in STEM.
We need you all.
You've been listening to History Gap with me, Molly Goodfellow.
And me, Georgia McAndrew. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe and review if you can.
And keep an eye on our socials at History Gap on Instagram and TikTok and at History Gap Pod on Twitter.
We'll see you next time.
Bye.